This is Diana Mulder. I played Dr. Pulaski in Star Trek The Next Generation, and you are listening to Women Talk Sci-Fi.
Hi, this is Jerry Donaldson.
And this is Eugenia Stapira.
And welcome back to another episode of
Women Talk Sci-Fi.
Woo-hoo! And we're going to talk about Gidang.
Woo! One of our favourite shows.
We're going to talk about Doctor Who, but we're not going to talk about it much because the gentleman that we're actually going to talk to knows a heck of a lot more about it than we do.
Does he ever? And in fact, Gary Russell, who is the person we interviewed, probably we have a lot to thank him for as Whovians, because he was one of the ones that kept Doctor Who magazine going all through
and the mythos of Doctor Who, really, yeah, over the years.
All, but especially during that time when Doctor Who wasn't on our television screens between the 80s and up to the 2000s.
See, he was really a fan, and he was responsible for the magazine, Doctor Who magazine.
He was. He was the editor for the Doctor Who magazine.
For years.
Yes, for years and years. He was also script editor on Doctor Who, and been part of Big Finish. He was the lead person in Big Finish. So he is a fan who's just been involved in Doctor Who.
He got to live his dream.
He did. Dreams do come true. And it's just amazing because this is where I guess one person's dream
helped make other people see part of it.
Yeah.
You know, share their dream basically with many, many, many people and be instrumental in bringing that back into the mainstream.
Because without him and people working with him, I mean, Doctor Who could have easily done a death after it finished in the 1980s.
Well, it did, except for small things like the magazine and the annuals and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the Target books.
Yes.
And for the rest of it, if it wasn't for them, maybe Doctor Who would be gone.
Yeah, because it would have just faded out of people's sort of
psyche
and that sort of thing. But the magazine certainly kept it very much alive. And then when Big Finish started, it was another way of getting whole new stories without having to read even the Target books, because they then went on to extra stories that were outside of the TV show.
And we recommend that if you're into Doctor Who and other classic iconic shows, including Stargate and Sapphire and Steel and
Blake Seven
and other things, that you can actually listen to, you know, different stories in those particular eras.
Yes,
of television.
Big Finish do a wide range, and as you said, not only Doctor Who, and they're very reasonably priced too, compared to, well, any audio book costs a fair amount, but if you do a subscription, I believe it's much, much cheaper. So it's
gives you an opportunity to listen to things that you haven't heard
and to listen to people who are involved in the show, especially if you're into Doctor Who, or in fact any of the other ones that they offer. They usually try and get people.
Well, every Doctor who's still alive still does Doctor Who, including David Tennant, including Matt Smith, all of those Doctors, like all the way back to the alive ones.
Tom Baker is now doing
David Tennant's father-in-law. The Doctor is still doing Doctor Who's and so on, Peter Davidson and so on. So if you want to still have a David Tennant Doctor, Big Finish is the place to go to and so on and so on and so on.
That's correct. And I guess for Paul McGann, that's probably where he became the Doctor.
Well, everybody knew. Well, the Whovians knew he was a Doctor.
It's yes.
Just the public didn't really take him on as one.
That's true.
So it's very nice for us that we're really Whovians that saw him as a Doctor, him now being actually recognised as being a Doctor.
And through Big Finish, he really got to live more of the Doctor stories, because he's probably, well, up to recently, the most recorded Doctor of all the Doctors.
He's also a really nice guy and a great actor.
He is.
And that's what we're actually going to do now, is stop talking, because Gary is doing a lot of talking.
He is, and his story is incredible.
Yes.
And he certainly still has a passion for Doctor Who.
And this is a bit of social history in terms of Doctor Who in impact on not only Gary, but his world in which he developed and helped continue and carry on. So if you want to know history of Doctor Who,
listen now.
To be sure.
And I usually have same set.
Because we've had too many things fail occasionally.
Okay, you two finish each other's sentences. This yes. is really, you've been doing this too long.
Yes, we have.
Yeah.
2009 we started the podcast.
That's far too long. I remember when podcasts were new things and they I didn't were. Understand them. And people said, oh, you can download them from iTunes. And I don't know what iTunes is. Modern technology. Very exciting.
Well, we're a little bit more chick savvy than
that. Do you actually want me to start this and be sensible now?
No,
be a grown
up. Don't want to be sensible. Grown-upness is not...
Gary Russell, I'm a grown-up, sensible 51-year-old man who is mature and sophisticated.
And has a love for Doctor Who.
Yeah, that's gone out the window then, isn't it?
No.
Yes.
Have you always been along...
Yes.
Have you...
Yep.
This is going to be one of those interviews, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes, I have always loved Doctor Who.
One man show, because we'll just
go for it.
Is anyone going to finish the sentence here? We're living in a conversation filled with ellipses. So do you think, really? Oh, absolutely, yes. From the very young age, I have two older brothers, and my mum and dad were very good at doing whatever they wanted to do on a Saturday, and they would, that sounds worse than I mean, they would go out and do things. My mum used to run dog shows and things. So my brothers, kind of on a Saturday, would become my babysitters. And I think they must have obviously watched Doctor Who from the beginning. Certainly my elder brother would have done. So I got plonked down in front of it. So my kind of earliest memory of it is not realising until years later what I watched, is William Hartnell turning into Patrick Troughton. I remember that final sort of 10 minutes of 10th Planet very vividly. And it wasn't until the DVD came out with the reconstruction that they... And I just watched it and went, oh, my Lord, that I really... All my memories are absolutely accurate. Because pictures and things you'd see and I would think, oh, maybe I've just misremembered things. But when I saw it animated, it was like, yep, that is the imagery I have as a sort of three-year-old watching... What I didn't know, what I thought was actually three old age pensioners, one of whom fell over. Because that's how I remember it, because it was black and white TV and they all had sort of blonde hair and that was what my grandma looked like. So that to me is what I... And then I must have watched it on and off over the years, but none of it really sunk in. And then I do remember Evil of the Daleks being on because... By that point, my elder brother drifted away, but my middle brother and I would fight over it because he wanted to watch The Adventures of William Tell, which was on ITV. So my mum's solution to this was, one week it's William Tell, one week it's Doctor Who. So for me, it was 2 weeks at a time for Doctor Who. So, of course, the concept of this is a seven-part story or this is a six-part story and I'm missing all 10 episodes didn't really sink in. I just somehow seemed to always pick it up. But Daleks fascinated me, and I was very in love with Daleks. And from that point on, I watched Doctor Who every week after the Daleks. There was no more William Tell. He lost that. Doctor Who became my focus, and I would sit and draw pictures of the title sequence. I can't draw, by the way, to save my life, and I couldn't then either. But that's what I thought I was drawing.
So when did you make it a career?
Well, I got into fandom... Very late. I got into fandom 79. And I went to my first convention in 1980 and sat there and thought, in that kind of arrogant, egotistical way that I've kept with me ever since, I could do this. I want to get involved in this. These people don't know what they're doing. And what I really wanted to do was do the interviews. I was thinking, I could go down there and interview those actors better than these people are doing it. So I kind of did that of walking up to the people organising, saying, when are you next to a convention? And I was 17, 18. When are you next to a convention? Ask me, I'd like to come and interview these people. And they were like, yes, very good. Bye-bye, strange Doctor Who fan. But I did kind of keep pestering. And so I wormed my way into the Doctor Who Appreciation Society and ended up on their organising committee and editing the newsletter and doing all the interviews at conventions. And through various means, that meant I got to know people and talk to people. And part of my job as doing the newsletter was to get information about Doctor Who magazine and what's in the next issue of Doctor Who magazine. So I'd phone the editor up every week. And one day out of the blue, he phoned me up and said, do this newsletter, and it seems to be very good. I'm looking for people to write for Doctor Who magazine. Would you be interested? And I was like, yes. So I was probably 20, coming up to 20 at that point. And I met up with Alan, and we sat and talked about it, and he said, well, write this, see what it's like. And that was it. That was the first time I got money in my pocket from doing something to do with Doctor Who. And I carried on writing for the magazine for the next 10 years. And then one day, John Freeman, by that point, was the editor. And he just said to me, you've been working on this magazine for long enough. Why don't you come and work full-time on the staff? And I was freelance at the time. And I went, work at Marvel Comics in the UK. Yes, please, I'll have a bit of that. And that was it. And I walked in on my first day to edit Doctor Who magazine. Well, I came in as John's assistant editor. And this was a bizarre, for reasons that are too long and boring to go into, I started on a Thursday, not a Monday. And I walked in on this Thursday, and John said, right, here's where we are with issue 183. There's the cover with the giant robot on it. There's this feature. There's this. This is it. This is your designer. This is the art team. This is blah, 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 blah. This is the cup of tea place you can have. All of this sort of stuff. And then he said, oh, by the way, I'm off to America for 2 weeks. So good luck. And I'd been in the building 4 hours at that point. I thought, thanks, John. Cool, man. But great baptism of fire. So I finished off that issue, and then he came back, and I hadn't burnt the office down or had the magazine cancelled or put a picture of Katie Manning posing naked with a Dalek and all those other things you don't do in Doctor Who magazine. And so a couple of issues later, he moved on to other stuff and I became full-time editor.
And how hard was it for you at that time when Doctor Who wasn't on our screens to keep that magazine alive?
Well, it was difficult, but I looked at it from the point of view of what Doctor Who magazine could become, and sort of did, really, with me, was a reference work. I'm very inspired by part works and things like that, and pull out and file things, because that's what I did as a kid. I'd rip magazines up and put them in little binders in a OCD kind of...
Cut out pictures.
That's right, yeah. Make scrapbooks and all this sort of stuff. So I thought, okay, there's no show on TV, so let's not pretend there's going to be a show on TV. So, what have we got? We have a book every so often coming out from W.H. Allen, which is a Virgin New Adventure. We have a VHS coming out from the BBC. I have Andrew Pixley's archives, which have all been mapped out as to what's going to be where for the next 4 or 5 years, because that's how long it's going to take to finish it. So I would sit down and go, right, if the archive is in the centre of the magazine, you could pull out that 8-page section and file it away. So you want to surround that with an interview or a feature about something to do with whatever that archive is. Mm-hmm. There's the DVD release. So make sure there's an interview and a feature about that DVD release. Mm-hmm. Right, so if your archive is going to be a Patrick Troughton story and your DVD is a Peter Davison story, the rest of the magazine needs to be either Tom or John or whatever. So you didn't get bits from all seven Doctors in every issue of the magazine. But you made that balance. But the archive and the DVD release, or video release, would be my central focus for creating the sort of reference thing, so that if you were mad like me and pulled things out, you could create a whole little binders about each individual story, with the archive as the main thing. Oh, and there was an interview that came out when the video came out, so we put that in our little plastic folder as well. That was my idea. And so I did that for 3.5, nearly 4 years.
Because that's amazing, because I'm thinking, you almost have to recreate the same story over and over again.
Yeah, and you're reinventing the wheel, because you're doing a magazine that had been running for 10, 15 years at that point. But I was lucky, because I was working there. I was there for the 200th issue, which I was able to go to town on. I was there for the 30th anniversary, so I could go to town on that as well. I was being treated very seriously by BBC Worldwide, because they were like, it's the 30th anniversary, everything we need, every bit of information we're ever going to need, oh, well, let's ask Gary, because he seems to know what he's talking about. So I ended up writing all the blurbs and everything for the, you know, there was a period, I don't know if you ever saw the British VHSs of Doctor Who, but they inside used to be a little fact file about them. Well, I did all of that, we created that, I wrote all of those. So it was things like that. It was very nice. We even won an award, which I have at home in a little plaque from BBC Worldwide. They won some industry award for marketing of the year for the 30th anniversary, and they gave me a plaque as part of that because I'd done so much for them for it, which I thought was very sweet and lovely of them. So, you know, it was things like that. So as time went on, as projects would come into BBC Worldwide as the years went by, Their go-to person became me for that sort of little short period of time. And it's like, oh, who can we... Oh, get Gary to write that. Oh, Gary can... Oh, get... Somebody wanted to write a book, we'll get Gary to fact-check it. So that was great. So that led to a number of other things, including the very first proper Doctor Who computer game, Destiny of the Doctor, which was terrible. Absolutely terrible. Really, really well-meaning. The guys who designed it, Studio Fish, were brilliant. They had lots of great ideas, but the money just kept getting cut and cut and cut. But we got video stuff with Anthony Ainley, and we had new voice stuff from Tom and John and everyone. It was just a brilliant thing to work on. And then that led to me doing the novelization of the TV movie, because somebody somewhere was sat in an office and they said, we're going to do this. Somebody who'd worked with me on the computer game said, oh, get Gary Ross to that. He wrote our computer game. He could write your novel for you. That's how everything seems to go, is a sequential thing of being in the right place at the right time and not pissing people off. And then suddenly people go, oh, well, he's reliable. He does things on time. Sometimes.
So did you aim to be a writer when you left school? I mean, what did you want to be?
Well, my background's an actor. I started acting at the age of 10, and I did that sort of on and off till I was about 19.
Because you're in the Famous Five.
I was in the Famous
Five. Which is very really popular available over here. On YouTube, in fact.
Well, or, better still, it's available on DVD and you can go and buy it.
Well, when
thanks
they
for
see
that,
the first one...
On they won't want to buy any more, you're quite right.
No, I'm saying it'll give them a taste, yeah. And then they can run down to the shop and actually buy
it. Yeah, yeah, thanks for that, yeah. Yeah, let's encourage people to watch things illegally on YouTube. That's really cool. Jeez.
He's a smart man.
I have no idea what you mean. I'm charming and elegant and sophisticated.
And he says he's reliable, so...
Yeah, and I'm also a consummate liar. So, Famous Five, which is huge out here, which I was... is brilliant because I still get a lot of emails and things from people, and they're always from Australia, people who have just picked up the DVD and show it to their kids or something, and it's really nice.
I actually listened to the Famous Five audiobooks again 2 years ago, because Enid Blyton is obviously
amazing.
If you're from the UK, yes. Enid Blyton.
And Australia.
She must be big out here
but
as well.
What I mean is she was a big iconic...
Yeah.
Author from the UK, she is one of those. And I in fact, just listened to Mallory Towers again.
I would have been brilliant in Mallory Towers, I think. Or St. Clair's. I would have been fantastic as a sort of 14-year-old schoolgirl.
Yes.
But let's not go there. So I'd done acting. So yeah. That was my main thing. And that's kind of why I think I got into the idea of doing interviews at Doctor Who conventions, is because my background was showing off. I mean, acting and performing. So that sort of that came very naturally. Now the writing thing really came out of nowhere. It came out of Alan McKenzie asked me to do stuff for DWM, and me thinking, well, all right then, I'll give that a go. My first Doctor Who novel was published in 1994. I'd never written fiction before. That was a complete flash in the pan. I just suddenly thought, I've got a really good idea. Story's a really good. I've got a really good idea. I want to write a book. Came out of nowhere. I submitted it, and by some insane miracle, Peter Darlevens commissioned it, and it was like, oh, I can actually do this writing thing. I'm enjoying
it.
So
that's part of the new adventure series.
Yes, yeah. But I was never at school. I did English. I'm thick. I'm genuinely pretty damn thick. I have no qualification. I've got 2 English O levels, and that's it. So I left school when I was 15 and a half. I never did A levels. I never went to university or anything like that. Everything I did was sort of, I don't know, born out of, I think, by doing acting from such a young age, I kind of was a little bit more grown up than people at school, because most of my life was spent with adults, yes. Mm-hmm. And adults treated you as an equal, not as a child. So I was probably a bit pretentious, but at the same... Well, actually, I was very pretentious. But at the same... I felt I was awful, horrible person. But it made me get on with adults far better than I got on with kids. So school I hated because... I have discipline problems and authority figures upset me and still do today. So I couldn't wait to leave school. I had no wanting to go to university and hang out with people my own age and have to deal with teachers. It was like, that's just awful. I just want to go out and work and earn a living and be real. So that's what I did. I regretted to some extent the university thing. I think now looking back, if I'd gone to university, I'd probably be slightly saner, probably a bit more well-rounded, much better at relationships, and might have a qualification. You know, I might be able to go, I have a degree. But that
probably
said,
never worked on Doctor Who magazine.
Well, this is probably true.
On...
And everything I've done in my life, every job I've done, no matter what I've done, not having qualifications has never held me back, because I've never been asked. If I, my very first job at the BBC when I was 19, on my application form it said qualifications, and I put O-level English, O-level English language. That was all I had. That didn't stop me getting a job. After that point, I've never in my life had to write down anywhere what my qualifications are on a job application.
Well, you spend your life learning how to do a job. Mm. I mean, university gives you just ideas how to do a job, but you actually live doing the job.
I think it gives you... I mean, I would always encourage, if I had kids, I would absolutely encourage them to go to university, because I think what I missed was growing as a social person. I was quite insular as a late teen, because I found people of my own age irritating, because I was so used to grown-ups, and it's like... I'm hanging around with 17, 18-year-olds. I just want to punch them because they're so thick and they're so screwed up by hormones and running around, and things that shouldn't be important were important to them, and I would be there. And they all thought I was a bit hoity-toity and a bit stuck up and a bit kind of, ooh, who thinks he's better than us? And it wasn't that I thought I was better. I was just like, I don't know how to relate to you people. All my life has been around grown-ups. So I think if I'd gone to university, I'd probably be a more rounded, successful, social human being. I'm not very sociable. I'm not particularly I'm quite gregarious and outgoing, but it's all a little bit of an act, and I do think, oh God, someone's going to work it out eventually. But I'm not good in social situations. I'm not great at dealing with people. I'm terrible with kids. You're in a Doctor Who convention and people have kids, and you know, you see the Katie Mannings and people like this, well, fantastic interacting with children, and I'm like, don't bring it near me. And then a child will come up, and it might be a baby, it might be 6, it might be 10, and I'm like, hey, how are you? And doing all this stuff, but inside I'm going, just no, I can't interact with things like this. And I think university it teaches you to be a grown-up. It teaches you to be a well-rounded person. You have to work in society. You have to learn to live with other people. So I wish I'd done university for that reason, but not for the education reason. I think if I had gone to university, I wouldn't have a degree. I would probably have come out after a year going, oh, I can't do this, because I would have just clashed with lecturers and teachers, because that's what I did at school. I think that would have carried on to university. I'm sure there was an answer to a question there somewhere, but, you know, I'm waffling absolutely uncontrollably. So did I always want to be a writer? No, I didn't. But once I'd started doing it, both factual and fiction, I went, oh, this is what I love doing. I enjoy this. I actually hate the writing process enormously. I love coming up with a story, and I like finishing a book. That's enormously satisfying. And going, I created this. The actual process of sitting at a keyboard... Oh, there's a deadline. Oh, there was a deadline. that doesn't excite me, but the creative process does. I'm not sure I'm making myself clear on that. The physical thing of typing I hate, but the creativity that it garners in me I absolutely love. But I'm a very bad writer. I'm not disciplined at all. I can't work from a synopsis. You know, every single book I've ever had, what's the synopsis? Oh, there's your 2-page synopsis. I don't stick to that. The amount of times Justin Richards, when he's doing Doctor Who books, has phoned me up and gone, I've read the book. Doesn't really resemble what we commissioned, does it? And I'm like, well, the beginning and the end are sort of there, and the title's the same, probably. But you're right, the middle bit. A lot of writers will tell you that they sit down and they get all their friends to read their stuff as they're going along and taking ideas and help and advice. I can't do that. For me, a novel, a book, has to be completely me. If there's influences from other people, I feel cheated. I feel that's not my book. So the only person I will work with is the editor. And if it's a Doctor Who book and it's Justin, it's the best editor in the world. He's just superb. I don't know whether it's because he just... knows me and just goes, oh, here we go, I have to do with Gary again, right? Everyone else is simple, you're a pain in the arse, and we have to work with you. But I really enjoy working with Justin. I enjoy doing Doctor Who books for that reason. But I can't have other people read stuff. I'm quite protective of it.
That's why you become a producer, isn't it?
That's just ego.
Is it?
that's just I want to be in charge. I want to run the thing. No, it is. It is a bit of that because, I mean, I didn't choose this current path I'm on at all. It came out of the blue. I was freelance again. I'd left the BBC. I'd stopped being a script editor. I was sitting at home, you're flashing.
Well, it's coming to an end, but that one's still going.
Right.
Yeah.
I thought it was going, just kill him. Kill him now. It's a flashing red light. Kill, kill, kill. I was freelance. I'd finished at the BBC, and out of the blue one day, I got a phone call from people in here in Australia at Planet 55 saying, hey, do you want to come to Australia? And I went, why? And they explained, and I said, yeah. And what they needed was a series producer, and they'd got this show off the ground at the ABC, but they wanted a series producer, and the ABC, people at the ABC knew me through my work on Doctor Who, and did a big tick. Boom, here I was. And then a few months later, I actually ended up running the show and becoming the executive producer and doing the whole creative side of it as well. And running the business, which is always a disaster. Never let me run a business. Because I'll just spend all the money on bananas.
And you're close up there. Bananas come from just up where you're living.
Do they really? Because local bananas taste funny, I'll tell you that. It's one of the things about coming to another country is it's the little things that just taste slightly different. Mm. Bread, just slightly different from the English taste. Turkish delight. I'm a big fan of, you know, Turkish delight covered in chocolate. Delight. Tastes completely different here.
Really?
It's just as nice, but it's a completely different taste. Maltesers. I love Maltesers. Maltesers in the UK are made with milk chocolate. Here, they're made with not quite dark chocolate, but it's a lot darker, more cocoa-y. Yeah. And it's little things like that I love. You know, you find something. And it's things you find that I'm used to, because I live a sad, solitary life back in the UK. I'm used to microwave meals and filling the freezer with crap. So I do that, obviously, here. And there are certain things that you can't get here that I would get at home. Like, I love jacket potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
When in the UK they invented jacket potatoes that were microwavable, frozen ones, I was seventh heaven. Takes 3 minutes, you stick them in, you have a beautiful jacket potato. So I have searched Coles and everything all over Australia looking for frozen jacket potatoes.
No, I've never heard of them.
No. They're gorgeous. They're absolutely amazing. So it's little things like that about living in another country I find frustrating but fascinating. Because and you start to adopt, there will be loads of things that I now get here that when I go back to the UK, I'll go, oh, I can't get those in this shop because they're an Australian thing. Your milk tastes much nicer here, I will say that.
Really? You'd think that the English green grass milk.
I know there's definitely a different taste to milk in this country, particularly skim milk. Because I try not to drink full fat, you know, because I've got this to get rid of. So I drink a lot of skim milk, and it does taste a little bit nicer here.
So how hard is it to move country for a job?
I suppose physically not hard at all. You get on an aeroplane, you pack your bag, and you go bye-bye and hello. But emotionally, for me, it was a huge wrench. I said to people, after about 3 months of being here and being terribly homesick, I said to people back home who'd done similar things, how long did it take you to adjust? When did you stop feeling homesick? And they went, oh, about 3 or 4 weeks. And I was thinking, I'm sitting here thinking, I want to go home. I miss my house. And I'm, you know, here a year and a bit later, I am as homesick today as I was the day I first came out here. And I've realised it's never going to go away. I've just got to live with that. It's not a problem. I can deal with that now. That's fine. But it does make me know that I will eventually go home. You know, when I left, my mum and various friends were going, oh, you won't come back, will you? You'll never come. I couldn't quite work out whether it was, oh, you're never going to come back, are you? Or whether it was, please tell us you're never going to come back. I'm never sure which way around that was.
But you're not actually living in an Australian capital city, for instance.
No, I thought I was going to be living in Sydney. I was originally, I think that was the sort of come to Sydney, because they all knew I love Sydney. And I thought, ooh. And then about 3 weeks before I came over, oh, no, we're not actually in Sydney. We're in Gosford. Well, we're just out, a bit further out. There's a place called Erina, but you wouldn't be living there. You'd actually be living even further out. And I'm looking it up on Google Maps going, that's a long way from Sydney. But, you know, Central Coast has a world of its own and a feeling all of its own, which I quite like. And if I lived in the UK and I was on a sort of waterfront, nothing would be as beautiful as where I am in Avoca. Because to wake up every single morning and look the length of this room, which is, what, 30 foot, 25, 30 foot?
Yes.
And to look out of my bedroom window and all I can see is the ocean crashing on a beach and hearing, more importantly, hearing that sound, I'm like, yeah, this is the Australian dream. This I am very happy to live. But I think I'm happy to live it because I know that it is finite. I think if I moved over here lock, stock and barrel, I'd probably be fighting very, very hard to move to Sydney and be in Sydney and be in the city. Whereas at the moment I'm very, very happy to be up on the Central Coast because it's picturesque and it's quiet and it's pretty. And, you know, we're doing something up there that's never been done before. We're running an animation studio with local talent. That's great to take a bunch of 18 to 26-year-olds and give them work doing something they love doing that they wouldn't very easily have much of a chance to do elsewhere, because animation, 2D animation at the moment, is not a big business. I think in another 5 years it will be, because I think, like all these things, it goes cyclic, and we've caught the beginning of a wave, and I predict in 5 years' time a lot more animated shows will be traditionally frame-by-frame animation, and 3D computer-created flash animation will be a thing of the past.
Because the company you're working with has a connection with Doctor Who as well.
It does. It did the 10th Planet and the Moonbase reconstructions for BBC Video, and I arrived for about the last month of the Moonbase. So that was quite an interesting baptism of fire.
Filling in the holes that are missing, if we can...
Yes. Yeah, so there's these Doctor Who stories that the BBC brilliantly wiped completely, and the audios existed. And in the case of the Moonbase, two episodes remained, and two episodes only existed on audio. So Planet 55 animated, frame-by-frame animation, these missing episodes using picture reference and background references and everything like that to make it all go together and follow the original camera scripts and make it all work.
So have you still got a connection with Doctor Who? Are you still writing books?
No, I really and truly, I kind of, when I left the BBC... I sort of thought that's probably going to be it. I think I did one update to my Doctor Who encyclopedia about 6 months later. I'd love to do a Peter Capaldi novel. I really would love to do one. But I think they've got their new stable of writers, and it's, you know, oh, that's Gary, he's old hat. He's from the David Tennant, Matt Smith era. So I don't think I've probably got anything else to do with Doctor Who. So I've kind of written that off to myself. I thought, oh, that's it for Doctor Who. So to come over... ostensibly to do Prison Zero, but then find I was actually working on the last month of Moonbase, it was quite fun. Not least because I was able to turn around to people and go, that's not quite how it should look, and oh, Patrick Trant's hair's wrong in that shot compared to the previous shot. And they'd look at me and go, it's important. The hair's got to look the same, you know.
It is important.
So it was quite fun being sort of mildly involved in movies. I mean, there'd been 7.5 months of it without me, so I don't want to give the impression I came in and worked on it. All I did was just, I was there, keeping an eye on stuff for the end of production of it, really. But that was the last thing I think I did with Doctor Who. I don't think I've done anything since, no, other than, you know, suddenly coming here for a nice convention, and some lovely Scot says to me, oh, do you fancy going to Melbourne and Adelaide and Sydney? And I was like, yes, because I've been up on the Central Coast working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day for the last year and a half. How nice. I'd not been able to go to Melbourne. I've never been to Adelaide. I mean, I've done Melbourne in the past, but I've never been to Adelaide in all the times I've been out to Australia. So it was just an exciting opportunity to come out here and see what places are like and meet new people. And it's been great, you know. It's been fantastic. Today's been lovely. Such nice people, apart from you two.
Of course.
Evil people. They're evil. They're actually holding a gun to my head and telling me I have to say nice things about them, and I'm ignoring them. So if you hear a bang and a thud... they're obsessed with death, these two, as well.
We are.
They're telling me about, you know, what they're going to do with everything when they're dead. It's great fun. I love talking to people about death. Makes me feel really young and vital and alive.
Well, you are young, vital and alive, aren't you?
Yeah, for only about another half an hour at this rate. That was good. That was a motorbike. Trying to get away from us.
We'd love to talking to you.
I'm sorry.
But you need to go have dinner soon.
You need to have some. That's the problem, because we have
quarter past seven.
And we haven't even touched on your script editing with Torchwood.
Let's race through that then. Right. Come on.
So, script editor. How did you become that?
I was doing a book on the making of the new series of Doctor Who. Russell had asked me to come up and do that. I kept popping back and forth to Cardiff. And eventually when I interviewed Russell for the book, and he said, you know, you've been doing Big Finish, what, 7 or 8 years? Do you plan doing that for the rest of your life? And I said, well, don't know. It's a nice job and it's fun and it's creative and I'm in charge. Those are all good things.
We didn't even talk about Big Finish.
And that's true. And he said, well, what do you really want to do? And I said, well, you know, I always had ambitions. I wanted to be like Terence Dix. I wanted a script edit, you know. But I never became a script editor. But that was sort of the ambition I had, and use all the stuff I'd learned at Big Finish. And, you know, not on Doctor Who. I was never thinking about it. I just wanted to get into TV drama. And then about a week later, I get a phone call from a man I've never spoken to, who apparently I've met, saying, oh, Russell and Julie want me to talk to you next time you're up in Cardiff. Let's have a quick chat about, you know, script editing and what you think it's about, and I'll tell you how it works and everything like that, you know, if you want a hand. I was like, oh, that's very kind.
Yeah, tomorrow.
Yeah, well, it was about 3 days later. I managed to push it to that. And I went up there, and he chatted to me and explained, you know, the situation and how BBC drama worked these days and how different it was from the 80s when I last worked at the BBC. And this went on for about an hour. And he went, so, when can you start? And I went, I was like, what? Is this a job interview? And he went, it wasn't when it started, but it's become one. Russell's very keen for you to become part of the team on Doctor Who, particularly because he knew I had a background in licensing and merchandising through working at Doctor Who magazine, through doing Big Finish. I understood how BBC Worldwide worked and the importance of brand and all of that sort of stuff. And he wanted someone to keep an eye on that. And I went, yeah, thank you very much. When do you want me to start? Oh, next Monday. Oh, okay. So I drove back to London and I phoned Jason and Big Finish, and I said, got something to tell you. And he went, oh, Jason's offered you a job. Russell's offered you a job, hasn't he? And I went, yeah. When? Monday. So I had to wrap up Big Finish stuff. And the BBC were great. They actually allowed me to carry on doing a lot of my Big Finish stuff and going back to London to do days of recording this for about 6 months. So for about 6 months, I was doing two jobs. But that was great because that gave Jason time to get Nick in to take over from me. And Nick had big plans and wanted to change everything. And basically, that's the Gary Russell era. Off it goes. Here comes the Nick Briggs era, which is exactly what you should do when you take over something like that. You don't want to hang on to anything from the past. And that was nice. So I got to wrap up all the projects I wanted to wrap up at Big Finish. And then there I was. And on my first day, literally my first day at the BBC, I'm sitting there going, what am I doing? No one's here to talk to me. I don't know what to do. And this nice man walked past with a pile of scripts and said, oh, you're Gary, aren't you? And I said, yes. He said, have a look at these and see what you think. And it was Torchwood. It was the first, I think it was 10 or 11 episodes of Torchwood scripts. And they just started shooting it. And I sat over the 2 days and I devoured these Torchwood scripts, including a couple that never actually went to screen. And I said to this guy, who was Brian Minchin, who was the script editor, I said, this is amazing. Oh, God, I never realised this is what Torchwood was going to be about. And he said, well, you know, if you want to come up to Tone meetings and get a handle on what happens at Tone meetings, come to the Torchwood ones, you know, it's fine by me. And Brian was great, he took me under his wing, and he taught me really to be a contemporary script editor. You know, I had ideas about what it would be from people like Terence. And Brian kind of showed me how it worked. And before I knew where I was, Julie Gardner was saying, well, you know, do you want to do Series 2 at Torchwood as a script editor with Brian? He'll do the first six, you do the second six. I was like, you would be having to fight me off with sticks from Torchwood. I would love to do it. So, because I was madly in love with Torchwood. Second season, oh my God, I so love Season 2 of Torchwood. And while I was doing that, the opportunity came in to fill in for Lindsay on the second series of Sarah Jane. She had to go and do something else. Oh, do you want to fill in for 2 or 3 weeks just at the start of the series, get things rolling? I leapt at that because it was Liz. And I can't remember why, but suddenly Russell turned around to me and said, oh, you're staying on Sarah Jane. I don't want to change script editors. You know, you've kicked all this off. Stick with it. And so I did the next 4.5 years of Sarah Jane. I say, did season two of Torchwood, and in between that, I did the last three David Tennant. Actually, my only credit as a script editor on Doctor Who is Waters of Mars and End of Time 1 and 2. But I was around for everything, and I had to be across everything of all three shows to do all the BBC Worldwide stuff, to do all these approvals. So I was in on every tone meeting, every meeting. I was just this awful shadow presence in everyone's way.
So when did you sleep?
Well, regardless of that, when did you realise that your three-year-old self took over your life and led you on this Doctor Who journey?
I think my that little three-year-old with his 10th planet obsession probably pops up in my life every so often. Certainly when I was doing Doctor Who magazine, it was like, oh my God, there will never be anything better than this. My first novel came out. There will never be anything better than this. Cardiff. Oh my Lord, there never will be. And there will never be anything better than that in terms of Doctor Who. But that's why I'm, in a sense, quite happy to have taken a step back from Doctor Who at the moment, to come here and do Prison Zero, which is nothing, other than being a sci-fi show, is nothing to do with anything to do with the world of Doctor Who, and I can leave that behind, because it's the only way to go forward. I kind of hit the pinnacle of everything I could do with Doctor Who by working for Russell for 6 years and Stephen for a while. You know, what would be the point in doing anything else? Unless I could have Stephen's job. I wouldn't mind Stephen's job. That would be quite a good job. Thank you, I'll have Stephen's job. That will be my next thing. But no, to then come over here as a producer and then become an exec and run my own show and run my own studio and work with the ABC and all of that sort of stuff, that's a whole new set of ambitions. It's like my life has gone slightly zigzaggy all the way along. I've never had a career plan. I've never been someone that says, I want to be here in 5 years. I want to do this. I've grabbed opportunities as they come and seen where they take me. I have no life or career plan at all. And suddenly here I am in Australia, where 18 months ago, if you'd said you're going to be in Australia, execing and show running your own program for the ABC, I'd have gone, don't be stupid. That's the last thing in the world anyone's going to give me the chance to do. 51 years old especially. You know, TV is made these days by people in their 20s and 30s. There aren't many old fossils like me getting a chance at this age to come in and do something suddenly. So having done it again, grab it, run with it, try not to cock it up. But it's brilliant. If I died tomorrow, the only thing I would think as I lay there conking out would be, I have had the most fantastic life. I've no regret. Nothing in my life do I regret at all. And I've achieved everything I ever wanted to do as a kid.
And more that you didn't realise.
Yeah. Every opportunity just grabbed and taken, and I've had a brilliant, brilliant time. And Doctor Who has been 90% the backbone of all of that. And everything I have done in my life, even if it wasn't about Doctor Who, has spiralled out of Doctor Who. Because even me wanting to be an actor came out of my love for Doctor Who. Watching Doctor Who, watching stuntmen, watching people being killed by axons and autons, that made me think, I want to do that. I want to be one of those people.
So it's really an amazing journey of a fan of Doctor Who, isn't it?
And I mean, and still am a fan. I never stop being a fan.
Because I'm sitting here thinking, what should we name this podcast from? Because sometimes
the man who never shuts up.
No, I'm actually thinking it should be something like the ultimate Doctor Who fan's journey. Or something.
Ultimate. I hate ultimate. When I did the Doctor Who Encyclopedia, I refused to let them have the word ultimate on the front of it. What's worse is they stuck the word definitive on, which is an even stupider word to put on a book.
A Doctor Who fan's journey.
Yeah. Yeah. Some frankly unimportant Doctor Who fan's journey.
Well, obviously not, because you've contributed in most of the media that are available, be that written.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got.
I've done books, comics, video games, audios, the TV show.
And spin-off. The spin-off as of that TV show. So, and then
God, I am magnificent.
You are.
And then you finish that, as you said, with a little bit at the end of finding Lost Who and putting it back together again.
Yeah, well, I don't want to take any credit. That is nothing to do with me, but working with it, who did. Yeah, working with some amazingly talented artists, most of whom had never heard of Doctor Who, never knew what Doctor Who was, and they still grabbed Moonbase and 10th Planet and ran with it and made it brilliant.
So this is really, this job that you're now doing, is really the first job that you've had with no Doctor Who in it ever?
You're right, absolutely.
Are you going to code?
Well, it's not. It's the first job I've ever had that's got nothing to do with Doctor Who and or the BBC. Let's put it that way. But yeah, oh my lord, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, of course I'm going to keep it magnificent. I love the opportunity to create a new universe. And I'm taking, again, I'm taking bits of a universe that was set up by other people, but I pull all those pieces together and reshape them and threw some of their ideas out and brought a whole load of mine in. And I've got a really good team at Planet 55, a fantastic script editor in David, great producer in Josh, a brilliant head of animation in Sean, and all their ideas have come into it. I can't sit there and go, everything you're going to see on screen is me, it's the team. And then you've got the animators on top of that. And all of them, I went in there on my very first day as the guy in charge and said, right, new regime, my attitude is not, this is one person's show, as it had been before, this is our show. So all of us, the only way we're going to make the show is if we're all in love with it. And that means every idea, everything you want, we will talk about. I believe, that's the socialist in me, you know, I believe in cooperatives and I believe in sort of, we're all in this together and it's all for the common good. That's how I want to run my company. As best I can when I'm dealing with Jason Haig-Ellery's money, which I'm still spending like wildfire. It's great. After all these years, I'm back working with Jason, spending his money for him. It's fantastic.
It's fantastic. Amazing life's journey.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
And he's brought me here to Adelaide. That's the latest bit.
And with somewhere that, to new. Us.
Yeah.
Yes, and to us.
Yay! Fantastic. Fantastic.
Thank
ladies
you
of sci-fi.
So much for
thank
your time.
You.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for asking me.
Good morning, everyone. This is Christy Lang. I played Marion in Once Upon a Time, and you are listening to Women Talk Sci-Fi.
So we want to thank Scotty Liston.
We love Scotty, don't we? Scotty is so good to us.
For our interview with Gary, again, we had an opportunity to spend the day with Gary, and he is quite a really lovely man.
And very interesting. His stories are brilliant.
And he's been just involved in so many different projects, you know, for he's just gone from one end to another, and he just, I think I did ask him in the interview, does he ever sleep? Because he just seems to be involved in so many different things.
So hopefully you'll find Scotty at
firstcontact.com.au.
First Contact Conventions, isn't it?
Yes. firstcontactconventions.com.au.
You're going to have more outtakes than me. Again.
Yes. I haven't started well, no.
No, not at all.
Told you I was out of practice.
Okay. I need...
Hang on. Farewell.
Ah, well, I suppose we're supposed to do that at the end of every podcast. So it's... What is it, Eugenia?
It's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from her.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.